I added one more podcast to the giant podcast bin. Now you have plucked that podcast out and started listening.
I took my microphone and found some human folk. Then I recorded all the noises while we spoke.
My name is Adam Buxton, I'm a man.
I want you to enjoy this, that's the plan.
Hey, how you doing, podcats? Adam Buxton here. I am outside, walking along in my hiking boots in the county of Norfolk, East Anglia, UK. It's the middle of May 2021. It's quite cold, certainly a lot colder than it was this time last year, if I recall. Gamboling in the increasingly tall grass is my dog friend Rosie. We're here for a bonus episode, because technically the podcast is on hiatus until later in the year. But if you recall, at the end of the last episode with Lee Mack, I did say that there was a possibility I might be dropping the odd episode now and then before the next run recommences properly. This is one such episode. That's a seagull. Hello, seagull. A lone seagull. Bonus episode, yes. Buckles checks his notes on his phone. Right, I'm calling this a bonus episode of the podcast because, despite containing a highly entertaining conversation with my old friend Joe Cornish, it has a significant promotional aspect to it. And I want to be upfront about that, yeah? Transparency. First thing I'm promoting is the paperback publication of Ramble Book, which is a sort of a memoir that I wrote. Have I mentioned it before? Well, just to remind you, this is a book I wrote that came out last year in hardback. It's amazing. And main themes include growing up, falling in love, trying to figure out your parents. Well, not your parents, my parents, well, mainly my dad. Getting into music and films, personal and professional failures, worries about money, class, death, and feeling conflicted by David Bowie's output in the 1980s. There is, as well, don't forget, an audiobook version read by me, featuring specially made jingles for each chapter, and an hour-long exclusive conversation with Joe at the end. Because, of course, my friendship with Joe Cornish is an important part of Ramble Book. But, hey, look, we've covered all that in the audiobook convo, me and Joe. And in this conversation today, this is all new stuff that, I mean, you know, yes, some of it we will have touched upon before. But this is an all new conversation. And I suppose it gives you a glimpse of what you might expect from a Ramble Book sequel. And that gives us an opportunity to talk about our working relationship with what I would call unprecedented candor. Okay? The other thing that I am promoting in this bonus episode is my auction of incredible pop cultural memorabilia in aid of MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. Currently, their volunteers are providing much-needed medical assistance all over the world, especially, sad to say, in India, which is being hit so hard by COVID, and in Israel and Gaza, where the fighting is affecting so many people so badly. If you're listening to this podcast sometime between May the 14th and May the 24th, 2021, you can browse and bid for items in that auction now. You will find a link to my eBay page in the description of this podcast. You all right, Rose? Or you can go to the front page of my blog, adam-buxton.co.uk, where you will also find details. And if you have no interest whatsoever in bidding for items, of incalculable cultural significance, then please consider making a donation to MSF, if you're in a position to do so. Thanks, either way. And final thing, please come and join me for an hour of waffling about the items in the auction and maybe a bit of Q&A on a live YouTube stream next Tuesday, the 18th of May, 2021, at 7:30 p.m. You can expect to see rare and exclusive pictures, clips and reminiscences of The Adam and Joe Show, my days filming on Hot Fuzz and working with Radiohead.
We've heard all those stories before, though.
Rosie, no you haven't. Anyway, I'm going to be digging up some bits that have never seen the light of day.
Ooh, that reminds me of those small creatures I killed and then buried and then dug up again.
Rosie, what have I told you about being macabre?
Sorry.
All right, back at the end for a small slice of goodbye waffle and a mention of another exciting film project that I was recently involved with. But right now, with Joe Cornish, who I spoke to via the Zoom last week, 6th of May, I think it was. Here we go.
I think it's very exciting that your book's coming out in paperback, because that's not like a done deal.
Is it not a gibbon?
It's not a gibbon, no. It is sometimes a book like when we did the Adam and Joe book, right? Very famous book.
Yes.
I was thinking, oh, they'll do a lavish hardback edition. And then when that sells to the aficionados in large numbers, 6 months later, they'll release it in paperback, you know, for the less wealthy fans. But no, they decided to put it straight into paperback, didn't they? Whereas, like other comedy series, like The League of Gentlemen, like proper comedy series, had proper hardback comedy books that were just their scripts, even.
I know, but that's a slightly different thing. Like special comedy books, they don't really exist, comedy books, in the same way anymore. Because you used to have a show like The Young Ones, for example, and then you'd have the spin-off comedy book, and it was very much a throwaway affair. Like How to Be a Complete Bastard, that was never a hardback, was it?
I don't remember. All I remember is that I was a bit disappointed when the Adam and Joe book went straight to the cheap seats. But suffice to say that it's impressive that Ramble Book came out in hardback and now is coming out in paperback, just so that every member of the public is able to wallow in its wonders.
That's right, and that's why it has a beautiful redesigned cover.
Ooh.
Helen Green, who did the artwork for the, she does the artwork for the podcast and she did the illustrations for the hardback of Ramble Book. She's done a whole new cover that looks like, well, it's supposed to look a bit like an 80s film poster, a bit like the Labyrinth film poster.
Ooh.
And it has David hovering in the background, as well as a big picture of my dad. And you and Louis are prominently featured on the front as well.
Yes. That'll boost sales.
Well, that's the idea.
Mm.
We're hoping that will boost sales.
Yeah.
It was a bit of a problem, though, because, you know, part of it is about my childhood, my experience of growing up in the 80s.
Mm.
So there's a lot of terrible white males in it.
Yes.
And not so many of any other kind of person.
Mm.
I mean, there's the only women in there are old girlfriends and passing mentions of Sigourney Weaver, perhaps. So I've put them all on the cover.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can market it towards people who are more right wing.
That's not what I want.
Big adverts in the right-wing press.
Enjoy the good old racist, sexist days with Adam Buxton.
Maybe a quote from Nigel Farage. Have you got quotes on there?
No, I went quoteless.
Did you think about having quotes on there? Because I gave you some, didn't I?
I took a stand against quotes.
I gave you some for the hardback.
You did.
But you didn't use any. I thought maybe you might use one.
No, I think they...
No.
They might put quotes from some of the reviews on the back. I'm not sure. But quotes. I wish it wasn't necessary to have quotes. And I certainly didn't want to do the whole business of emailing every single famous or mildly famous person I've ever met and asking them to.
That's terrible, isn't it?
No, I don't want to do that. Who would be the best person to have a quote from on the front of my book?
Curry.
Edwina.
Edwina Curry would be really good. That would really, especially after what you said about the content being a little bit, you know, a little bit
retrograde.
Retrograde, old-fashioned.
Old-fashioned.
Nostalgic.
I'd like to point out at this point, listeners, that it is not in that way retrograde. It is forward look. It just happens to be the reality of my life is that I am a white male man.
Who grew up in a segregated community. in an all-male
environment.
Segregated community. Listen, the other thing I'm curious about is, are you going to release a paperback version of the audiobook with like thinner audio and like cheaper versions of all the musical stings read by a soundalike?
Yeah, that's a good idea. Who would do it?
I don't know. Like, who's the sort of Poundland version of Adam Buxton?
Man, that's a tricky question because I'm the Poundland version of so many other people.
Well, you just maybe hold a competition for your listeners and see who did the best Adam Buxton impression.
It's got to be someone middle-aged, inoffensive, warm. Mm-hmm.
Schofield, you're describing Philip Schofield.
Yeah, Schofield would be great. I bet he'd read it really nicely.
Schofield, he's expensive though, you'd never get him.
No, that's true.
I mean, he's massive. But listen, I think you have a competition with your listeners, and the one who does the best Adam Buxton impression re-records the audiobook and also does all the stings. Have to make sure they were like less good. And then you release it at, like, what's the price differential between the hardback book and the paperback book?
I think what was
like that? A tenner? Is it like a £10 cheaper or something?
No, less than that. I think it's probably more like about five or six quid cheaper.
Okay, so maybe like it's got to be like, say, 35% less good.
Yeah.
It'd be the same words, but just printed on the audio equivalent of lower quality paper.
Yeah, more compressed audio.
Yeah.
That's a good idea. Also, they could mispronounce a lot of it.
Yes.
I'm listening to an audiobook at the moment that it's a really great book. I'm not going to say the name of it, though, because the fellow reading it, who is, he's doing a good job most of the time, but he's got some very odd ideas about pronunciation. And he also does a strange thing where he'll just pause in random places in a really odd way. So, like, I'm going to read from my book right now. Louis was more intelligent than most people in our year, despite having been...
I know what this book is. It's Louis Theroux's autobiography, and he's writing about himself. Is that what it is?
No,
I know what it is.
This is from my book. Despite having been accelerated from the year below, a fact that sometimes made me a little wary of him. He literally does that, this guy who is reading this audiobook I'm listening to right now. Also, check out these mispronunciations. Today he said, instead of enviable, he said enviable. Enviable?
I'd stop the recording and go back and re-record that if someone said that, wouldn't you?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure he had a producer on this thing. It's a big, important, clever book. Anyway, another one was, instead of saying placate, he says placate, like placenta.
It sounds wrong as well.
Instead of draughtsman, he says droughtsman.
What?
Droughtsman.
That's absurd.
I mean, what was the producer doing? Just smoking loads and loads of drugs.
Can I ask you some more questions about the paperback book?
Yeah, man.
Does it have a preview chapter of Ramble Book 2?
Well.
To whet the appetite.
Yeah.
It should do.
I thought we could do that in this conversation.
Excellent.
I mean, Ramble Book 2 is not 100% a done deal, but it is a possibility.
But that's okay, because there's nothing better than something that's sort of promised, but never turns up.
Mm-hmm.
Don't you think?
Yeah, I do. Just saying, yeah. haven't really thought it through. I mean, now that I'm thinking about it, no, that's one of the worst things there is.
No, but it's like legendary films that are never made.
Oh, I see.
You know, like Stanley Kubrick's Napoleon. And then you get a big or Jodorowsky's Dune.
Okay.
And then you get a documentary and a big coffee table book.
You mean in the cultural sphere? Yes.
Well, it's all potential and no disappointment. You know what I mean?
Yes.
It's all, you always imagine the best possible version. And it's never sullied by the
dreary reality.
By the actual existence of something disappointing.
Yes.
So talk about Ramble Book 2, have a sample chapter, sketches, discuss it, be working really hard on it, talk about it a lot in forthcoming podcasts, then never do it.
You know what? I've actually written some ideas down. One of the main things that people said to me when they wrote to me about Ramble Book 1, I got a few comments from people who had read Ramble Book, loved it. They loved it.
Can I just interrogate what you've said so far a little?
Yeah, go on.
How are you receiving these messages? Letters?
Letters and emails via my agent. And they thought it was incredible. But one of the things they said they wished there was more of was stuff with you and I.
Mm-hmm.
You and me. You and me is the right one
you,
there.
You and mine. You and my.
My and yo.
Did you look at the reviews on Amazon?
No. Didn't read any reviews.
Honestly?
Yeah, no, I tried to remove all that stuff from my life.
Don't. Did you look at the reviews on Goodreads?
No reviews. Haven't read any reviews. I've only received feedback from other human beings.
Via letter. That's a good way to do it, man, because you're unlikely to actually make the effort of writing to you via your agent or publisher unless you really love it or you're so angry about it. It's entertainingly ridiculous.
Yeah, that's my theory. If people had a massive... I mean, I'm absorbing generally where the areas of potential criticism may be. Perhaps a little bit too much Bowie in there.
Right. How are you getting those vibes? Just sort of psychically walking through the streets of Norwich in the hubbub?
Well, no, I can decode it from the things people say in their letters and their emails.
Right,
but
people
did wish that there was more stuff about you and me being on TV in the 90s. Mm. So obviously the structure that suggests itself for Ramble Book 2, rather than going through the 80s, this time we would go through the 90s. And obviously that was the decade that you and I managed to get a TV show on Channel 4. And our friendship underwent a transformation. Or at least it was put under a certain amount of strain. So that's one question. Mm. How honest should I be about some of the more tense times?
What are you afraid of?
A lawsuit from Jay Korn and Associates.
What do you think? Like, what's the darkest corner?
Well, I don't know. I mean,
I don't think there's anything too bad. I mean, I don't know. I've forgotten most of it.
No, but I mean, you don't... Would you rather... Because I remember when we were doing the DVD, the Adam and Joe DVD in 2004, I was editing a kind of behind-the-scenes story of Adam and Joe, it was called. And there was a sequence in there... There was a couple of sequences that I'd edited together where we were just being bad-tempered with each other. And you said... What's the point of including this? I think that it doesn't. You don't really need it. And I felt like I'm always drawn to that sort of stuff because I want to. I've got a sort of confessional urge to share that sort of thing and confess to the times when maybe I behaved badly or there was tension. I want to share it. Anyway, you made that point, and I left one little section in there, but I did remove another one. And it was definitely a good thing to have removed it because it would have just been a bit weird and brought the whole thing down. So I guess I'm worried about doing that.
It seems to me you've got a very good editor.
Yes.
And that he or she would probably do that job for you. Because in the end of the day, you don't want to repeat beats. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You don't want just to have the same story beat, so to speak. So if you found the nugget that expressed all that and wrote it really well, which I'm sure you would, then... You wouldn't need to dwell on it that much. As long as it was fair and reflected me in a very good light and you in a poor light, which would represent the actuality of the proceedings then that would be fine. That would be fine.
Yeah, okay.
That would be fine. But yeah, no, I see that you're listening to your podcast. You're on a journey of self-discovery. And I can see that that would be interesting station stops on your journey.
Okay, good.
The next station stop is Self-Loathing 1998. Please make sure you remove all your baggage from...
from your life.
From your life. The next station stop is a passive-aggressive argument with Joe about Skittles versus M&M's.
I found a diary entry I wrote when we were on the radio on XFM, 2005.
Ooh.
And we got in a tiz with each other. Do you remember that?
I don't. No, remind me.
Like when we used to be on XFM, you would read the messages that were coming in on the computer while I was sat on the other side
of
the desk.
Oh, yes, of course I remember this, yeah. And you didn't like me reading out the provocative ones.
No.
People that were angry.
Yeah, yeah. And in between, like when we were playing music, sometimes you would say, wow, look, check this one out. And you'd read it out and it would be just people saying, like one of them was, I still remember it, why don't you infantile C words shut up and play some music?
Yeah. I mean, I have to say that was a refrain that continued at BBC Six Music, even when the show was very popular, because a lot of people just tune in to hear music and they don't like people talking.
Yes.
But no, I remember you getting very annoyed at that. But that would be fine. I think this is all fine. It's so long ago.
Yeah.
I think it's all fine. I think you should really get in there.
All right.
I think it would be exciting. It would be like Hunter S. Thompson or, you know, one of those scurrilous tell-all books. That's what you want from a book like that. Like the Motley Crue book or a really good rock biography. You don't want the anodyne version, do you?
Wow, this is great. I mean, you are absolutely pushing me to...
I did say earlier that as long as it reflects really poorly on you and brilliantly on me.
All right, I'll bear that in mind.
That's the caveat.
That's good. Because already I've started to write some of it. Like I wrote about Titanic and what that meant in terms of our relationship. And then that was another point of conflict when we did that interview with Time Out. Do you remember? And Time Out phoned me up when Titanic was going to be broadcast on Film 4, when Film 4 launched. And it was on their first night of programming. They showed the full director's cut of your brilliant Titanic toy movie.
Yeah, brilliant.
But Time Out phoned me up, because that was back in the day when we kind of were scrupulous about never saying like who did what on the show. It was always like we did everything together. And they phoned me up, and I think they quoted me as saying I a couple of times rather than we, which we always tried to do. And then you read it back and you were very upset because really you
I'm
did
getting upset now just hearing it again.
You did almost all the work on Titanic.
Yeah.
So you phoned me
I'm
up and
furious.
And you said, what the fuck have you said now?
Oh.
Like I was always saying terrible things.
What that would have been pent up rage.
Yeah, I thought that would be a good little spicy nugget.
It's just like, pent up rage, like a little hot steam geyser over a volcano.
Little rage.
When you're just having a little stroll.
Rage fart.
Across the arid tundra. And suddenly a hot geezer spouts up your backside. But I think this is fine. I have to say, like, you can test drive some of these points of antagonism and see whether I've got anything left in my system, you know, and there's nothing. That's fine. You've told that story, in fact, I think, either in your podcast or in one of your...
I talked to Richard Herring about it.
Speeches about yourself.
Yeah. On other people's podcasts.
Yeah. That frankly all merge into one long self-aggrandizing monologue.
We were doing, you and I, an interview for the Radio Times the other week because the Adam and Joe show is now available to view on BritBox.
Oh,
all four series. And so we were doing an interview about that. And it was a strange experience because it was the first time in, well, 25 years that we, or thereabouts, that you and I had done an interview about the Adam and Joe show. And it was strange how we slotted back into our respective roles and started trotting out the same patter that we used to when we were interviewed about it in the late 90s and early 2000s. Except that at one point you said, I finished making quite a good point about how the whole DIY aesthetic was important to me because it was a gesture towards kind of decentralizing the power of television and all that. So anyway, it was a great little speech I made. And at the end, you said with the Radio Times interviewer, yes, I remember you saying that in the 90s when we were interviewed, and it's still as boring to hear you say it now as it was then.
Oh, yeah, and your point is? Where are you going with this?
I don't know. Where am I going with this?
I don't think, didn't I say that? I think, yeah, I think I set you up for it, actually. And then you followed on by sort of repeating it, and then I shut you down.
Yeah.
To move things on.
That's how we do it.
But it all sounds good. I'm really looking forward to Ramble Book 2, even if it never appears.
How about, I need some stories for the sequel. What are the big stories that I didn't write about in the first one, about us in the 90s that I can tell?
Well, you could do everything, couldn't you? Like, Takeover TV was weird for me. Because it was basically your gig.
Mm-hmm.
And I was working in film as a runner, but feeling very frustrated that I was sort of, you know, so near but yet so far to doing film. And then you got this offer to present Takeover TV. So you really got the break to actually be making stuff that was going to be... I'd had a couple of short films broadcast, but like at midnight on a Sunday on BBC Two and stuff. But in terms of actually being on television before midnight, you got that opportunity first. So that was certainly weird for me. And I remember sitting down with you in a cafe in Brixton, probably, and full of all sorts of weird feelings of, you know, competitiveness and just peculiarity that... this was what had happened. And also trying to think, well, you could, because I, you know, surprise, surprise, had quite highfalutin ideas of being a filmmaker. And then the opportunity that arose was not necessarily as dignified as, you know, one might, not, that's the wrong word, dignified, but, you know, not as sort of...
You had to slum it with Buckles being my sidekick for a while. And
well, it was quite...
And that must have been...
No, that was very... I felt very privileged, but it was talking bottoms, wasn't it? I mean, both of us...
On Takeover TV.
Yeah,
I didn't do any...
Both of us felt a little bit... No, but some of the stuff on there was like...
Yeah.
Not necessarily what you would want... What your parents would want you to aspire to. So you really had to think like, okay, well, just the opportunity to put anything on is so valuable.
Yes.
Whatever it is. But yeah, I guess that's where that would have started for me.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's just a weird situation. It was a very unusual situation to be producing stuff for broadcast television entirely on our own.
Mm.
Very unusual in that year, in those years.
But did you have to give yourself a pep talk? Or did someone else give you a pep talk and say, hey, look, I know this is not exactly what you want to be doing. You want to be making films, not making weird late night trashy TV. But this is a foot in the door. This is an opportunity. You've got to go for it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I made it. I absolutely made a decision because I chucked in my job.
Right.
But I do think any conflict or weirdness probably grew out of the fact that it was basically your gig. Like, you answered the advert in the NME. You got asked by World of Wonder to present the show.
Right.
And then you came to me and said, help me out, man. And so it was always a little bit weird as to, you know...
Who's steering the ship?
Yeah, who's driving the bus? It always was weird. And there was inevitably, just because of... It's not as if we were a band... that had been gigging and the band was suddenly signed. It was almost like we were a band and you were the lead singer and you got signed And then you came to the band and said, you came to like the bassist or the drummer or whatever and said, listen, help me out. I need you to play with me on this thing.
Yeah.
So that was probably the source of it. I never thought I was a presenter. I always was a director and a writer and a sort of behind the scenes person, even when we did plays and stuff.
But the annoying thing was that you were better at presenting than I was, probably.
Oh, I don't think so.
That's the thing, is that part of the sort of skewed power dynamic thing was me being desperate to, on the one hand, maintain any idea that I was driving this thing or I got us this gig. But underlying all that was just this kind of chronic insecurity about, oh, I haven't really got the goods for this. And Joe's a lot more funny.
Yeah, but it happened very suddenly, didn't it? We didn't exactly, I mean, we had a bit of a run-up doing Takeover TV, but it did happen very fast. Before we knew it, we were being asked to fill 25 minutes on Channel 4, made of our own stuff. And this is obviously before YouTube and before creators really were as common as they are now. Well, that sort of thing is sort of around more, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think we can forgive each other and ourselves a certain amount of psychological, you know, wrangling, just given the circumstances.
I don't know. There's a lot of stuff I can never forgive you for, but I'm going to write about it.
Good. Okay. I'm ready.
Yeah. No, there's going to be gnarly, long passages of very bitter complaining.
Yeah.
And as much name dropping as I can manage.
Yes.
Like, who are the big name drops that we could do? I remember bumping into Ewan McGregor
mm-hmm.
at a gig in Brixton. I think it was, who was it? Maybe Blur or Beck. I think it was Beck we went to see towards the end of the 90s. And Ewan McGregor was over at the bar. And we had just done a parody of Trainspotting. With Toys.
That was the first thing on our first show, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah. And I went over to say hello to Ewan McGregor and said, we did a thing on Trainspotting on our telly show. Didn't say it like that. And he'd seen it.
Mm.
He said, yeah, it was great. I thought, wow, we have bust through into some other realm here. You do a name drop.
The first pop star we met was...
Baby Bird.
Was Baby Bird, and we were terrified.
Yeah.
Like, in retrospect, comparatively speaking, he's a brilliant musician, but he wasn't that famous.
Stephen Jones, he was very much a cult concern who had sort of busted through into at least the margins of the mainstream. He was a NME hero.
Super hot at the time, but we were terrified.
When we met him, he was just at the point where he was going to become a proper mainstream star for a while, I think. Because I don't think You're Gorgeous, which was his big chart hit, had come out when we met him. He'd just released four EPs or four albums of homemade stuff. And he got quite irritated, I remember, when we were asking him about outsider artist type. Like, we played him some Shooby Taylor.
Mm.
And we used Shooby in the theme tune for the Adam and Joe show. And he bristled. You know, he didn't like that people would assume he was into that sort of stuff, you know, just because he did homemade stuff. He's like, no, I'm trying to make my stuff as good as possible. This is just ridiculous what you're playing me. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. I remember that as being quite an excruciating sesh, though, because of our general levels of internal anxiety.
Oh, yeah. We were so nervous. We met him at the Chrysalis, in the Chrysalis building, you remember?
It just, everything seemed so, anything that was like official or part of mainstream media was terrifying to us, wasn't it? Because we were just a couple of homemade ninnies. And I just felt like a ninny.
Yeah, but also I really cared. And I think the best thing is not to care. Like, I cared in a bad way.
Yeah.
I was very self-conscious. And so that made the whole prank element that crept into the Adam and Joe show very...
very difficult. Tell me about it.
Traumatic.
Tell me about it. Write about it. Tell me about it in Ramble Book 2.
Well, I'm going to. I've already started writing that.
Have you?
Yeah. Shall I read you a little bit of what I've written about?
Yes.
That?
This is the preview of Ramble Book 2 that...
Wow, this is work in progress.
Yeah, it's exciting.
Sometimes Louis Theroux would suggest ideas for things he thought we should have a go at, and one of these ended up being in the first ever episode of The Adam and Joe Show. We went into a food store on Brixton High Street, and I filmed as Joe opened any package that advertised 20% free, emptying 20% of the contents into his pockets, then putting what remained back on the shelves. It wasn't long before we were approached by shop assistants asking what we were doing, to which Joe replied, "It's okay, we're just taking the free stuff." Our producer Debbie had got us permission to film in the shop from the owner, but his staff had not been warned, so their bewildered responses were genuine. When a few onlookers got involved and the mood shifted from bewilderment to anger, we called the owner, who emerged from his office to reassure staff and customers that it was all a hilarious prank, whereupon we made our grateful apologies and went back to the office to review our footage. There was just about enough to cobble a piece together, but a lot of what I'd shot was unusable because my hands had been shaking so badly. The thing is, I'm not a huge fan of pranks and practical jokes. Maybe that's because I'm really nice and don't enjoy exploiting another person's goodwill for a laugh, or maybe it's because I'm a conformist coward who feels threatened whenever the rules of society are disrupted. Or maybe it's both. And then I have a ramble, like a little tangential ramble, about Stanley Milgram. Do you know him?
Tell me who he is.
He was responsible for the electrocution experiments that tested obedience. There's a book about him called The Man Who Shocked the World. Do you want to hear my ramble about Stanley Milgram?
I don't know. Yeah, you're smiling, so I feel I'll hurt you if I say no. If it's shit, I can just look up on Wikipedia. I don't really care.
Ramble. In the early 70s, Dr. Stanley...
I'm getting the Milgram bit.
Milgram.
I'm getting the Milgram bit.
Yeah, you're getting the Milgram bit.
I tried to stop it.
In the early 70s, Dr. Stanley Milgram conducted an experiment in which he instructed his students to board a subway train in New York and ask someone to give up their seat, though there was no obvious reason for them to do so. You might imagine that most people would refuse, especially on the New York subway in the 70s. Surprisingly, though, around two-thirds of New York subway passengers gave up their seats willingly when asked to do so by Milgram's students. The results of the experiment demonstrated that the average person tends to be either more obedient or just nicer than you'd expect. Either way, the people affected most dramatically by the experiment were not the seated subway passengers, but Milgram's students. Deliberately disrupting these social codes was so upsetting that many of them felt physically sick. And I conclude, unless you're a sociopath, pranking, whether done in the name of entertainment or academic study, is painful.
That's what I liked about that Eric Andre film, Bad Trip.
Oh, yeah.
That the majority of the pranks in it actually showed the general public in a very good light.
Yes, exactly.
The majority of the time, they're trying to diffuse the situation or make the person who is comically suffering feel better. Bad Trip, I thought, really made me feel all... The vast majority of it made me feel really warm and cuddly, and that human beings generally were good, which is what Milgram found out.
Exactly. And the great thing about Eric Andre is that the joke is always generally on him. He's the disruptive element, and it's about how people react to it. You know, it's not all about humiliating people or making them look credulous or stupid. It's about, like, look at me, I'm totally out of control, and how are you going to react to this big dose of absurdist chaos being unleashed in front of you?
Yeah, because the second prank idea of Louis that we did, you've talked about before, you break it, you pay for it.
That's what I carry on and write about later on.
Yeah, so that's the sort of example of when the scales tip too far in the wrong direction.
Yeah.
when you're doing something that's genuinely...
horrible.
Yeah, horrible.
Well, no, it wasn't meant to be horrible. So this was a prank where we went into a shop that had a sign. It was a China shop in South London, and it had a sign that said, "You break it, you pay for it." So we went in and deliberately broke things and then paid for them. But the lady who was in there minding the shop, we'd arranged this with the guy that owned the shop, but the lady in there operating the till was quite upset and frightened by these people coming in, smashing stuff up.
The claw hammer was a mistake.
The claw hammer was a mistake.
Yeah, that was a miscalculation.
Oh, it was terrible.
Oh, it was much more fun just doing silly stuff like People Place.
Yes.
I just like just being silly and confusing and odd.
Anyway, well, there you go. That's a little preview of some of the amazing stuff that might go in Ramble Book 2 as far as our show went. But also Adam and Joe show related, as this is a nostalgic Adam and Joe show ramble. I am, of course, auctioning some incredibly rare and valuable Adam and Joe memorabilia in, well, as this goes out, it'll probably be next week.
Wow. What have you got? What's in the booty bucket? The Buckles booty bucket. Can I call it that?
That would be great.
Okay. What's in the Buckles booty bucket?
Buckles booty bucket. Let me check.
I mean, I've got crates of shit.
Crates of shit?
Yeah. And since we moved house, we've been slowly rationalizing everything. And it's the last corner of the last cupboard to be rationalized is Cornball's cornucopia of crusty crap. From our careers.
And what do you think the most valuable item you have is?
What, Adam and Joe related?
Yeah, or anything.
Oh, man. Well, a lot of my old magazines are actually quite valuable, like copies of Grand Royal, the Beastie Boys magazine. Old zines, Ben is Dead, stuff like that are actually quite valuable.
Really? Because
I've been looking them up on the internet. Yeah.
Like, for how much?
Like, I'm only talking like £100, that sort of thing.
That's quite a lot.
That's quite a lot for an old thing.
A worthless mag.
Worthless old mag.
I was going to auction off my sailor's hat and T-shirt.
Oh, my God. Wow. That's probably got Buckle's DNA in it.
That's got a load of DNA in it. Yeah.
Yeah, sweat. Anxiety sweat.
Yeah, rage sweat, anxiety.
Rage, Cornballs-induced rage sweat.
Cornballs-induced rage sweat, prank sweat, shame sweat.
You know that is the most delicious of all sweat. Like if anybody buys that, they should just strain some hot water through it and sip it. Mmm! You'll be taken back to those angst-ridden days.
Mmm, relaxing. What do you think I'm going to get for the sailor hat and T-shirt? That is a piece of iconic memorabilia from a legendary cult TV show.
Well, there's a couple of ways it could go. I'd say one way it could go is that you get its actual worth, which is probably about a tenner, but it's more likely to be somebody who actually wants to give money to charity, who's prepared to inflate the sum as a generous, as an act of generosity.
As a gesture.
Yeah, as a gesture, which that sometimes happens in charity raffles, doesn't it?
That's what I'm counting on.
Yeah.
Yeah, they want to support Médecins Sans Frontières and all
the... I mean, maybe I should buy it. So I'd have the full set, because obviously I've got the Joe T-shirts.
So there's the sailor hat and T-shirt. There is my Star Wars Jabba the Hutt model that turned up in many of our toy movies. And it also turned up in an episode of Travel Man with Richard Ayoade when I went with Richard to Lisbon. Also... Vinyl Justice items,
ooh,
a helmet with a record on top,
wow,
notepad and badge from the American version of Vinyl Justice on VH1.
Wow.
And then there's a few toys from the toy movies.
Oh. Like,
I would imagine that you've got most of the toys who appeared in your toy movies. However, I do have your Steven Spielberg from Saving Private Ryan.
Do you?
Am I allowed to auction him off?
Of course. I've got the Wonky House.
Have you got the Wonky House?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I've got the Wonky House.
That's
from
Chewbacca's
Wonky House from Chew've Been Framed.
Chew've Been Framed.
It's spinning around really fast and bits are flying off it. Say it like you said it before.
My Wonky House! What's happened to my Wonky House?
Anyway, I've got the Wonky House.
Anyway, I've also got a few toys that were in Star Trek Next Generation toy movie and the version of Snatch that I did called Twat. And I was trying to figure out if I should sell them as a job lot or individually. Probably individually. What do you reckon?
Yeah, I reckon.
More things.
Is there going to be like bartering? Is it like an auction like where you watch the sums go up?
Yeah, it'll be on eBay.
So at the end of the show, all the items have gone?
No, after the show, there will still be a day or two for people to make bids.
Right. Yeah, like international, like oil billionaires.
Yeah.
Australian billionaires.
Elon Musk.
When the word gets out.
And as this podcast goes out, the idea is that if you go to my website, adam-buxton.co.uk, on the front page should be details and links to the auction going on eBay. And there will be details of when the live stream is happening, where I just talk a little bit more, maybe show a few clips relating to some of the items.
What time of day is that going to happen?
That is going to be 7:30 on Tuesday, the 18th of May.
Prime time.
Yeah, Tuesday, the 18th of May, 7:30 p.m. Another couple of items that I have which are not Adam and Joe related are two of the helmets that I used for the Radiohead video for Jigsaw Falling Into Place that I directed with Garth Jennings in 2007. And they're bike helmets sprayed silver with a Dowling pole in the front. This was pre-GoPro technology. And they are both signed by Johnny Greenwood and Tom York. One of them, the camera, is still working, the little black and white security camera.
Wow. It's probably got some hairs trapped in it. Again, very good for a Jurassic Park style DNA.
That's right.
Extraction, if you want to do some sort of a Tom York theme park with clones of Tom York in big pens.
Yeah.
What would happen if the power went down in that one and they all escaped? Love fucking mind-bending music and some arguments.
We can't get modern angst back online.
But that's going to make that item very, 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 very valuable, probably just from a scientific point of view. And it's a little irresponsible to sell it to the public, really, because you don't know what hands it might fall into, you know, in terms of villains and what they would do with the Tom York clone. I'm just saying, be careful with it. Sure. What else have you got that's non-Adam and Joe?
I have a bit of Hot Fuzz memorabilia.
Wow.
So I've got, in 2006, I got the part of Tim Messenger. And for anyone who hasn't seen that film, spoiler, I get killed by the spire of a church going through my head. And they built a big reproduction of Abe Buckles and with a prosthetic head. They did a cast of my head and blew it up. And on the day where they did the special effect and exploded the head and lots of gore came out everywhere, I went around and I collected up bits of the exploded head. And I've got quite a good chunk of the face, which still looks weirdly like me. They did it twice. They did the special effect twice. So I got a nose from the first one, which really blew up, and there wasn't much left of that one. But the second one, when it blew up, there was most of the face. So I have the face from the exploded Tim Messenger model in a plastic bag with, it's still got bits of hair and fake blood on it. And and I have the name of my character laminated and put, you know, that went on my dressing room door when we were on location in Wells. And I have the call sheet and all the, like the list of all the shots and when they were done, when all the shots were done on that film. And I okayed it with Edgar. He said it was all right to auction this stuff. So what do you reckon? Hundreds of pounds for that exploded Tim Messenger face.
Well, yeah, that sort of stuff does fetch big money. They have auctions of movie props like that.
Oh, yeah.
And people spend thousands of pounds. But it's recognizable as you.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. Is it mountable in some sort of glass case or is it too bitty?
It's a bit bitty, McLean.
I tell you what you could do.
Go on then.
You could take it to the repair shop. Adam Buxton has bought the fragments of his face from the film Hot Fuzz. This was the peak of his acting career and it holds many fond memories. He brings it to Charlene, the face reconstruction expert. She will attempt to put it back together. Hello, Adam. What have you got for me here? You be you.
This is the prosthetic of my face that was exploded in the film Hot Fuzz.
Oh, it's amazing. Yes, it's very fragmented. Can you tell me what it means to you?
Well, it was one of my first film roles and one of my last as well. And they took the cast of my face, of my whole head, in fact, when I was quite hungover one day in 2006. And I remember when I saw the dummy of my character, Tim Messenger, I was sad because I thought, wow, I'm not a very attractive man at all.
Adam is going off on a tangent. Well, we'll attempt to put it together. We'll do our best. Thanks very much for bringing it in. We'll see you in a couple of weeks. This doesn't mean anything to you. You haven't seen this program.
No, I can imagine it, though.
Repair show. It's comfort television.
How long's that been on?
Literally all the time. for a few years. It's a big hit.
Is it?
And so then we go into a montage of these lovely experts in this beautiful woodland glade in this little rustic hut, working away at your face, stitching it. And every now and then they'll come upon a problem and they'll go over to another of the artisan repairers and lightly touch them on the shoulder and say, "Hello there, Stefan. Oh, hi. I got a little problem with the stitching on the face. Well, just let me have a go at that. I'll do." It's very soft and very gentle. They're very nice to each other.
Sounds nice.
And they'll stitch the face together and they'll source the exact same rubber and they'll get the right eyes. And then a couple of weeks later, you'll park your car half a mile away from the repair shop and then walk down a wooded glade where they'll film you. And you'll bring your daughter and maybe Edgar too or something. Maybe not Edgar.
Why am I bringing my daughter?
Well, that's what they do on the repair shop. It's very cozy and familial and emotional. And you'll come in and they'll have the face with a cloth over it. And they'll go, and Charlene will say, "Hello, Adam." I don't know, these aren't the real names. And then she'll take the cover off and there'll be your reconstructed face, beautifully done, just as if it was never crushed. Oh. And you'll say,
"Oh, wow."
You got to cry.
"Oh, wow."
And I'll walk around the desk and just give you a little hug.
It's really amazing to see it again. I feel like it's 2006 and all the bad things that have happened in the last few years haven't happened yet. But obviously 9/11's happened and the other things from the past, the bad things in the past, they've happened. But the other future things after 2006, they haven't happened. And that's what this phase means to me. Thank you.
It's been such a pleasure to work on it. Such a privilege.
Thanks.
Adam. Adam leaves with his reconstructed face. He gives it to his daughter, who wears it when she kills tramps. That's a bit of a dark twist.
That's a dark twist.
Very dark twist, I'm sorry.
Wait.
This is an advert for Squarespace.
Hey guys, it's Broshak with me, Paul Broshak. We got Mike here. We're going to talk about his new MMA comedy special. We're going to talk about his view counts, and we're going to talk about conspiracy theories. What's up, Mike?
Hello, Paul.
Hey, brother.
I'm fine, thank you. I don't want to talk about any of those things anymore.
You don't?
No. I want to talk about... I built a website, Paul.
All right, stream some fights, settle some beefs, stick it to the elites, that kind of thing.
No, it's mainly dog pictures, Paul. And I did it on Squarespace. Have you heard of Squarespace? I went to squarespace.com/Buxton and I did a free trial. And I tried some of the beautiful templates, Paul, and I typed things in. I dragged in pictures of the dogs. And before I knew it, I had a website, Paul. So I bought it and I've made some very sweet dog t-shirts and I sell those on the shop on the website.
Uh-huh. But do you still fight and stuff?
A little bit, but not really. Oh, and Paul, I wanted to tell you that when it comes time to buy your website or domain on Squarespace, if you use the offer code Buxton, you save 10%. Paul.
Thanks, Mike. Where'd you do that free trial?
Squarespace.com/Buxton.
And how sweet were the dogs?
Very.
Continue.
Hey, welcome back, Podcats. Joe Cornish there. And speaking of my daughter, I've just remembered I'm supposed to pick her up from cricket today. So I've got to walk back quite fast. Otherwise, I'm going to be one of those terrible dads, terrible dads, terrible, terrible, terrible dads that
turns up really late and their child is the only one that's left sitting on a bench looking forlorn and unloved. I mean, you never know, it might end up with her enacting that nightmare scenario that Joe Cornish was outlining there. Anyway, I'm very grateful to Joe for talking to me there, making the time. Thanks, man. Don't forget to check out those links for the auction for MSF. Please explore right now and maybe join me for the live stream on YouTube on Tuesday, May the 18th at 7:30 p.m. And of course, if you haven't read Ramble Book so far, why not check out the paperback? Now, I mentioned in my intro that I'd been involved in another feature film, another Edgar Wright feature film, no less. And yeah, this is a little bit of an exaggeration because it's not one of Edgar's narrative features. It is a documentary feature about one of my favourite bands, Sparks. It's called The Sparks Brothers. Edgar's been working on it for a few years now. And it is a comprehensive overview of the career thus far of Ron and Russell Male, two of the most unique, consistently surprising and delightful artists in the world of modern music. Zoo time, is she and you time? That's one of their most famous ones. This town ain't big enough for both of us. But in a career that has lasted nearly five decades? No, five decades. They made their debut in 1971. And they just keep on putting out interesting stuff in all kinds of styles across the decades. They are quite unique. And Edgar, being a longtime fan, spotted that no one had really done a doc about them, so he thought, well, I better do it myself. And that's what he's done, with the aid of many Sparks fans, including myself, who talk on camera about the band and their influence, alongside contributions from the Male brothers themselves, Ron and Russell Male, who are Sparks. Check out the brand new trailer for Edgar's film The Sparks Brothers. Link in the description. See what you think. The film itself is out in cinemas on July the 30th, 2021. Though, says Edgar, our Sundance London Q&A on July 29th will be beamed across the UK the night before opening. All right, that's it for this bonus episode. Thanks once again to Jay Korn. Thanks to Seamus Murphy Mitchell for his production support on this episode. Thanks to Acast for their ongoing support. I'll start putting out episodes of the podcast regularly after the summer, probably. But before then, yeah, there might be the odd extra episode coming your way. Until then, I hope you're doing well and you're in a position to enjoy the easing of restrictions. Don't go crazy with that hugging, though. We don't want another wave. And anyway, not everyone deserves a hug. But I think you do. Come in. Take care. I love you. Bye!